This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. And I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, at www.blueprintforwealth.org. And there I have videos, audio, and articles on tax topics, estate planning, and business planning topics that you might find of interest in doing your estate planning or business planning for the future. I also invite you to read my monthly column in the Washington Business Journal entitled Blueprint for Wealth, where I will also feature topics that we discuss here on the radio, as well as other tax, estate planning, and business planning topics. Today, we're going to talk about the flat tax. Everybody's been talking about it in the news. Governor Perry from Texas proposed recently a flat tax in his campaign to become president of the United States. And the Republican candidate Herman Cain also was most recently came up with his 9-9-9 proposal, of which one of those nines refers to a flat tax that would be imposed on the income of individuals. The real question is, what is a flat tax? Where did it come from? Is this the first time we've heard about it? Many of us know that that's not the case. And what are its prospects for enactment in the United States? Well, a true flat income tax is a system of taxation where one tax rate, 9%, 10%, 20%, is applied to all income. And that means there would be no deductions and no exemptions and no credits. That would be a true or pure form of flat tax. There's also something known as a marginal flat tax. A marginal flat tax refers to a situation where you allow deductions in a flat tax system. That means there might be a deduction or exemption granted for certain things. It might also mean that you grant an exemption for low-income people so that they are not subject to the flat tax. So it's said to be marginally flat above the point where deductions are allowed. And this main conceptual difference between a true flat tax and a marginally flat tax is really the source of the debate that's going on in evaluating the efficacy, the ability of these taxing proposals to make it through not only the election cycle, but also the U.S. Congress. Now, there are flat taxes that allow for limited deductions. Modified flat taxes have been proposed, which would allow deductions for very few items, while still eliminating the vast majority of existing deductions. These are known as tax expenditures. Charitable deductions, home mortgage interest, are the most discussed exceptions, but not necessarily ones that will make the cut. These are popular with voters. They're often used to entice the voters to approve of a flat tax system. Another common theme is a single, large, fixed deduction. The concept here is that a blanket deduction rolls up a myriad of ubiquitous fixed living costs and has the simplifying side effect that many low-income people will not have to file tax returns under this type of a system. Years ago, the Hoover Institute introduced a form of flat tax on consumption. It's known as the Hall-Rabushka flat tax, and it was really a consumption tax imposed by taxing income and then excluding all investment. All the way back in 1962, the noted economist Milton Friedman, in his book Capitalism and Freedom, also discussed the possibility of imposing a flat tax, except his system assessed a flat tax with personal deductions, but when deductions exceeded the income, the taxable income was allowed to go negative rather than just resulting in a zero tax, and the flat tax rate was then applied to this negative income and resulted in a negative income tax that the government had to pay back to the individuals or to the households. Anyway, the hard part in a flat taxing system is, first of all, what income is going to be subject to this tax? The central philosophy of the tax is to minimize compartmentalization of incomes into many different special or sheltered classes or cases. And this is a problem in today's income tax code. So, for example, the taxation of interest income and stock dividends are right now treated differently under our code. Interest income is taxed at a much higher rate, while stock dividends, under the recent legislation that was extended and under President Bush's tax proposals, stock dividends are taxed at a much lower rate. The shareholders own the company, and so the company's profits belong to them. If a company is taxed on its profits, then the funds paid out as dividends arguably already have been taxed, so that's why dividends are given a more preferential treatment. It's a debatable question. It's debatable whether they should subsequently be treated as income to the shareholders again, and therefore subject to what we call double taxation. In any event, the question is, what income is subject to this tax? Well, one proposal that has been floated recently was to tax only earned income. That was Steve Forbes' proposal back in the 1980s. Remember when he ran for president? And his proposal was to tax only earned income. What's earned income? Wages, salaries, bonuses. But his proposal would not have taxed interest or dividends. Now, some argue that that is not the sole basis on which to run for president of the United States, and I think that was one of the stumbling blocks to Mr. Forbes, who is a noted publisher and very in tune with economic theory, but he may have had some other deficiencies. In his case, however, in his defense, the flat tax proposal on earned income has gained recent support. For example, Sam Brownback of Kansas was one that proposed a flat tax in the mid-2000s that would have imposed this tax only on earned income and not on unearned income, such as interest and dividends. The second key component of a flat tax theory is to minimize the need to have deductions. So the question is how to eliminate deductions, and that is absolutely fundamental to a flat tax system. Deductions will dramatically affect how flat the tax is. Perhaps the single biggest necessary deduction is for business expenses. If businesses were not allowed to deduct expenses, then businesses with really low profit margins, in fact, perhaps below the flat tax rate, could never earn any money, since the tax on their revenues would always exceed their earnings. For example, take grocery stores. I don't know if you know this, but most grocery stores really only earn pennies on every dollar of revenue, perhaps excepting Whole Foods. They could not pay a tax rate of, say, 25% on revenues unless their markup on their goods sold, including all the labor that they have to pay, exceeds 25%. So corporations have to be able to deduct their operating expenses if individual citizens cannot. The difficulty is how to identify what is a business expense that is legitimate enough to be deducted even under a flat tax system that applies to corporations. The other way of looking at it is, well, perhaps this flat tax system should only be applied to individuals. Herman Cain's proposals would have included a 9% flat tax on individuals without real definition as to what he's taxing or whether he's allowing any deductions or exemptions. But it also would impose a 9% tax on businesses. Again, he hasn't really provided enough details yet for us to understand whether or not he's going to allow deductions. Now, the other issue in a flat tax system is equity, fairness of distribution across the population. Tax distribution across varying income levels is probably the most hotly debated aspect of a flat tax system. The Democrats oppose it because they feel that it's not fair to focus a flat tax rate, on extremely wealthy individuals at the same rate that individuals who are very low income would be taxed at. The controversy over the equity of the distribution of this taxing system is really divided into implementation and philosophy. One of the concerns with many flat tax systems is that they're really not truly flat taxes. And if that's the case, it's a progressive tax system like the one we have currently, one where the tax rate on total income actually goes up as income increases. The admission that such a tax is not actually flat actually undermines the whole notion of a flat tax system. So a true flat tax system has few deductions and few exemptions and really doesn't increase as income increases. The people who favor the flat tax system say that a marginal single rate is fairer than stepping up the marginal tax rate as income increases because everybody's paying the same proportion of their income. The people who oppose this philosophy, usually it's the Democrats, claim that the marginal value of income declines with the amount of income. In other words, $100 to a poor family is worth a lot more to them than $100 is worth to a millionaire. Clearly, this debate is going to continue throughout the election cycle and may have a substantial impact on who gets elected in the next presidential election. If you've got questions on taxes in general, or how flat taxes might work, or how it might affect you going forward, give us a call at Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Depending on your marketing strategy, a business may need to use a doing business as name, also known as a DBA or fictitious business name. For example, you run the business alone, and the business's legal name will typically be your name. But you may want to market the business as, say, Acme Appliances. In that case, the business's legal name is different than the name known by the customers. You're using a doing business as name. Most states require that such businesses register fictitious business names or DBA names. Using a DBA is common practice for business. The DBA will usually be the cornerstone for your marketing efforts and will work much more effectively than the business's name. Call one of the experienced business attorneys at Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. Call us at 703-218-2100 for more information on choosing a DBA and registering your business.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Andy Smith of the McLean Group. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Andy is a principal at the McLean Group, and he leads the McLean Valuation Services Group, which is the firm's business valuation practice. They perform business valuations for public and private companies for transaction, financial reporting, equity incentive plan, tax and estate planning, and various other purposes, I'm sure. And he's got broad experience in public accounting, investment banking, and financial operations management. He's been designated an expert witness in numerous court cases, and Smart CEO magazine named Andy one of Washington, D.C.'s top 50 CPAs. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
He's also recently authored An Insider's Guide to Business Valuation, a handbook for board members and executives. Tell me a little bit about that book. You wrote this book. Why did you write it, and how is it going in terms of people who are reading it and interested in reading it?
Yes, it's really focused on board members. So much of our practice is delivering business valuations to boards of companies. And the business valuation process and practice has changed so much in the last 10 or 15 years. And myself as a firm, we were concerned that we weren't being asked the right questions in those board meetings.
Is that right?
So many times the boards would say, thank you for the valuation, let's move on to the next agenda item. But there are questions that they should be asking. The business evaluation process should be a collaborative process. And we thought it was important to provide a book that's targeted as a handbook to the business executive and the board member.
How can we get a hold of that book?
It's on our website at the McLeanLLC.com.
Okay.
It's also on Amazon, of course.
Excellent. Is it selling?
It is selling.
It
recently has gotten out. Yes,
it's good. Not going to be a plug for the. This will be a plug for the book.
There you go. It's not going to be a Pulitzer Prize winner, but it is.
You know, it's an important tool that every board member should have in his quiver, or her quiver, so that they can really understand the valuation process. I would think so.
Yes.
And you know, you've been a CPA. You're a registered representative, investment representative, as I understand it, and you're also a valuation expert. As you look back on your career, what are the key milestones that you see over your career?
Boy, it's probably two or three. One of the first is, of course, the core values that you're raised with, going back to your high school and middle school years, which you know, of course, starts with your parents and the work ethic that you get from that and
sure.
playing football. And then while I was in high school, I had my own business, actually. It was the Potomac Driveway Service. Myself and a friend. We used to seal coat driveways in
sure.
the summertime, and we did it all through high school and college. It was quite successful. My parents were actually worried that I wasn't going to finish college and just seal coat driveways for the rest of my life.
Because you were making good money.
It was very lucrative. But it was a very entrepreneurial experience, and I've always been oriented towards an entrepreneurial path. And then going into college, I majored in accounting, which was the language of business. I was fortunate enough, I think, in high school to know that I wanted to major in accounting. I went to a good school for that. Graduated, passed the CPA, moved into KPMG as an auditor. And then the next big milestone for me was an opportunity to work overseas. I had my annual, kind of a funny story, I would have my annual review every year with my partner, and he would ask me, do you want to go overseas? And I'd say, well, matter of fact, you have 11 offices in the Caribbean, Bahamas, Bermuda, Jamaica. I love to sail. I can
yeah.
snorkel. I should be working for you in the Caribbean.
Okay.
He would laugh at me just like you did. And I go back and think about it. And eventually, the more I thought about it, I wanted to go somewhere that was totally different, where the language was different, the accounting, the business was different. I thought about going to China, but I didn't know the language.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said I could go to Russia. And within about a six-week period, I found myself from living in my parents' house for 3 years after college. 6 weeks later, I was living by myself in Moscow, Russia. Not trained in the language, but
wow.
There as an auditor. And this was in the mid-1990s, the late 1990s, where it was a boomtown back then. The stock market was up 600%.
Mm.
Coke and Pepsi, all the multinationals were there trying to grow their businesses. And while I was there working for KPMG, helping international businesses do transactions in the former Soviet Union and grow.
Right.
And that evolved into a three-year stint there. I spent a year in Moscow, and then myself and two Americans helped open an office, a KPMG office in Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan. That's not Moscow.
That's not Moscow. Especially back then. It was
yeah.
only about a couple hundred, it was only about 100 or so Americans living there.
That's right.
And there weren't so many restaurants. There were no McDonald's. It was definitely some urban living, some urban camping, rather.
So you learned a lot about yourself, I think, living overseas, particularly in an environment like that, didn't you?
You do. I think you learn a lot about yourself personally. You also get much more experience than you would get otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
You're in charge of a lot more responsibility, much longer hours to work, of course.
Yes.
Coming out of that, you do really sharpen a lot of your skills and gain a lot of new skills.
How did you get into the valuation world?
That's a good question. I have when I was overseas there, I was working on a lot of transactions, helping various companies buy radio licenses, telecom licenses, uranium mines, all kinds of assets that were there that were being privatized. And what was fascinating was the clients kept asking me, what's it worth? And I was there just to, you know, tick and tie and do the audit work.
Right.
But they kept asking, what's it worth? What's the value of it? And I got involved in more due diligence engagements. I enjoyed client service. When I came back to the U.S., I had gained some investment banking experience and then joined the McLean Group to start an evaluation practice there. The lead partner, Dennis Roberts, at the time, was he probably had a handful of evaluations a year. He would turn some down. So I joined him to really grow the valuation practice with him there.
And it's grown pretty substantially now.
It has. People tell me it's one of the largest in the Mid-Atlantic area outside of the big four accounting firms now.
Now, the McLean Group implies that you're in McLean, Virginia, I would imagine.
It does. It's one of the problems with the name, actually, is we're kind of stuck to McLean, not have the address.
But it's much bigger than that, isn't it?
It is. It is. We have bankers in 30 cities across the U.S. I also have a dedicated valuation office in Silicon Valley and one in Austin, Texas as well.
And what does the McLean Group do?
It's principally two things. So the first is middle market investment banking, which means we help sell businesses, buy businesses, and raise capital. And then as part of that, we have a very active business valuation practice. That's where I spend most of my time. And we value about 200, probably a little over 200 clients a year.
My goodness. So what are most of your engagements? Are they in the estate and gift tax area? Are they in the business valuation area for compliance with the financial reporting and the tax rules, or is it something else?
It really falls into two or three buckets. The first and the heart of our practice really is valuing that privately held company for some sort of equity incentive plan. It could be a formal DOL registered ESOP.
Department of Labor,
thank you. Or a phantom equity plan. And as you know, Wayne, those come in all kinds of shapes and flavors nowadays.
Sure do.
But there's still that fundamental issue of valuing what's one share of stock worth for that equity incentive plan. The next big bucket of our work is related to fair value accounting. In the past five years or so, the accounting profession has gone through a whirlwind shift from a historical cost model to a fair value accounting model.
Right.
It's probably one of the biggest changes in accounting for the past 500 years since Father Pasioli wrote the first bookkeeping book on it. It's a pretty monumental shift.
I don't remember that from my accounting course. Right. I just remember debits on the left, credits on the right. That's all I remember.
That's right. We like the debits. We don't like the credits.
That's right.
We also testify in court throughout the year. We do some estate planning evaluations and fairness opinions as well.
Okay. On the business valuation side where you're doing, valuing a share for an equity incentive plan, the fair value is the fair value reporting sort of driving that more than the what they call Section 409A, or both of them sort of influencing the fact that you've got to get these valuations?
Great question. It's really being driven by both of those parties. The first is the auditors are telling firms you have to get a business valuation done. You just can't sit around on a Saturday afternoon and flip a coin and say it's worth 25 cents this year and 30 cents the next year. They really want to have some auditable support behind it.
Because they won't issue an audit opinion without something supporting the valuation for purposes of when options or other equity incentives are being issued, right?
That's exactly right, because you have to value that stock option expense. It has to be valued. And then likewise, the IRS followed suit also, saying for IRS purposes, for tax purposes, there has to be some valuation methodology, some valuation report behind those numbers.
What are you seeing in the marketplace in terms of valuation reports? Do you see a lot of really high quality, or do you see a lot of errors being made? And if so, if you're seeing errors, what kinds of errors are people making who are in the valuation sector that they shouldn't be making?
We really see a whole wide range of valuation reports. The professional valuation profession has only been around for about 10 or 15 years, maybe 20 years, if you go back that far. And it's still evolving very rapidly. In our practice, we get a chance to review a lot of valuation reports. And there's probably two main errors or problems we see. One is on qualitative value drivers. Of valuation isn't as simple as saying, here's your revenue times a multiple is what you're worth.
Which all my clients believe is the only way that businesses should be valued, by the way.
Right, a nice simple formula would make it quite easy.
Can't we just use a formula? I mean, isn't it? Why do we have to retain an appraiser to do this?
Right. Well, the way I teach it is you can have two companies, for example, both at the Pentagon working, both with $50 million of revenues.
Okay.
So the debits and credits look the same. The value should be the same.
Right.
But one could be outside cutting the grass every day, and the other could be inside creating databases to capture bad guys. And it's those qualitative aspects of the business that will differentiate their value. And government contracting is a great example of that, actually, because there's so many qualitative value drivers that's unique to that industry niche.
Like clearances, right?
If it's clearances, the types of contracts, the contract concentration, a lot of those issues that are very important in determining value.
And if you're a small business and you're relying on your small business status to get contracts, that might depress the valuation, mightn't it?
That's correct.
So we've got lots of different qualitative value drivers is what you call them.
Yes.
What other qualitative value drivers should business owners be aware of when they're valuing their business? It's not just discounted cash flow, is it?
That's right. So many valuation analysts like to start crunching numbers, and there's a great...
Just jump right in. Here's a model. Here's my model. Fill in the numbers, and let's go.
Exactly. Here's a forecast. Here's some numbers. Here's some multiples. What's it worth? And it's really not a number crunching exercise. It's everyone says it's a balance of art and science.
Yes.
And it's really quite true. It gets very scientific, when you're doing a discounted cash flow analysis, and you have discount rates and forecasts and all these great scientific calculations. But the most important thing after you've crunched all these numbers in a little black box is to step back and say, does it really make sense? What do these businesses sell for in the marketplace? What are those value drivers? What differentiates it? As you mentioned, you have a government contractor, one with restricted contracts, one with unrestricted contracts, and those are very, very different valuations.
If you have a small company, a small privately held company, how do you know what it's really worth in the open market? Because there may be other companies that are buying, being bought, and being sold. How do you get information on other companies in the same sector with similar qualitative factors and that might be purchased and sold? Do you have access to that type of data?
We do. As an investment bank, we subscribe to 7 or 8 different databases of transactions, which is one source of information for us.
Okay.
We also have close relationships with various buyers, both private equity as well as strategic buyers.
Right.
And we're able to, since we work with them closely, we're able to have their perspective on business and business value and how they're analyzing the value of a business.
Now, we've talked about your book. I understand that you're also a teacher of valuation.
Yes, I enjoy teaching. I've taught for several years at NACVA, which is the National Association of Certified Valuation Analysts. I've been a national instructor with them. I've also been a guest lecturer at the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins MBA programs.
Fantastic.
And just last year, I was an adjunct professor at George Mason University's MBA program, which I really enjoyed.
Do they have actually courses in valuing businesses?
Just recently, which is great. There's an MBA course called Business Evaluation that I taught last year. And then there's one university out in Washington State that's just started a business valuation major where it's within the business school. You can major in accounting or finance or marketing. They now have a valuation track, which is fantastic. I think it's good for the curriculum.
And you said that the McLean Group also engages in mergers and acquisition advisory services. Tell us a little bit about that practice.
Actually, that's the core of our business. It's a combination of sell-side representation. We help sell businesses. We help buy businesses, and we raise capital.
How do you find a buyer for a company that wants to sell?
It's a process. It's all about a process. Typically, we start working with the client very closely. Investment banking is not a pure, it's not really a matchmaking service. That's always the misperception there.
You guys are not brokers.
That's right. There's a difference between a business broker and a matchmaker versus the investment banking process. An investment bank is about creating a market and managing the market to maximize value, to find the irrational exuberance and manage that market.
Mm-hmm.
Many times our clients will actually know who the buyers are, but we'll come in and manage that process.
I see. And if they don't know who the buyers are, you'll find them for them by virtue of the knowledge of the industry? Is that essentially how you do it?
It's industry expertise, knowing the industry, knowing who the players are, knowing who wants to be in the industry. Those are the ones who will typically pay the premiums, or the ones who want to enter the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And also that the private equity market has been very, very active the last 4 or 5 years, and remains active today. There's lots of cash there with private equity funds, and they're becoming more strategic in their valuations.
We're talking with Andy Smith of the McLean Group. Andy, if people want to get in touch with you and find out more about your practice and the McLean Group, how do they do so?
At our website, www.mcleanllc.com, and my direct phone number also is 703-827-0233.
And thanks so much for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth today.
Wayne, thank you so much.
And join us next week for another special topic and special guest on Blueprint for Wealth. And by the way, don't forget to subscribe to my blog at blueprintforwealth.org. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views